6. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Back in the 1940s, collector Albert Barnes said that Horace Pippin's artwork was, quote, distinctly American in its ruggedness, vivid drama, stark simplicity, picturesqueness, and accentuated rhythm. In fact, Barnes compared Pippin's paintings to the music of Negro spirituals. Horace Pippin described his approach to his work this way, pictures just come to my mind and I tell my heart to go ahead. Horace Pippin was born 125 years ago in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He fought and was injured in World War I and taught himself to paint. His work caught the eye of an art critic back in the 1930s who told illustrator N.C. Wyeth about this unknown African-American artist. His work can now be seen at the Barnes Foundation, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Brandywine Museum, and other venues across the country. So today on Radio Times, the life and art of Horace Pippin. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Judith Stein is a writer and independent art curator. In fact, she curated I Tell My Heart, The Art of Horace Pippin back in the 1990s. That was the first major retrospective of Horace Pippin's work, and the exhibit ran at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And Judith Stein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us is Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw. She's an associate professor of American art at the University of Pennsylvania. Her work focuses on race, gender, sexuality, and class in the art of the United States and the New World. And Gwendolyn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Nice to have you both with us. And Judith, let me begin with you. And I want you to describe, I guess, for our listeners, because we're talking about art on the radio, what is unique about Horace Pippin's work as an artist?
Well, it's his eye. When he said, pictures just come to my mind, they came to his mind because his eye saw things first. And you mentioned that he had been wounded, and so painting small was the easiest thing for him. So if you're listening and you've never seen a Pippin, first of all, you can rectify that easily to a museum in your neighborhood. But you'd see a smallish painting, often with vivid colors and small strokes, because again of the limitations of his arm, he turned these limitations into great abilities, because he kind of almost sculpted the clouds and the trees, and he painted memories of his childhood in Westchester and in Goshen, New York. He painted his experience as an African-American soldier during the First World War. He painted memories of his whole life.
How about for you, Gwendolyn? When you look at his work, and you're looking at some of it right now on your iPad there, what do you see?
Well, I think with Pippin, his work really speaks to a moment in American art history and culture when the folk and the popular was ascendant, when it was incredibly current for a lot of American critics, writers, artists, people who were interested in music, were all looking for ways to call American cultural production unique, different from that of Europe. And Pippin comes to the fore at that moment, which also corresponded with the era of the Harlem Renaissance and the rise of what sometimes we call the New Negro Movement. So to look at Pippin's work is to see a slice of the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s from an African-American perspective, from a Pennsylvania perspective, where we can see daily life, but also personal experience and memory, and it gives us a sense of what it must have been like for African Americans like Pippin, newly returned from service in World War II. In World War I, as Judith mentioned, some of them injured, as Pippin was, coming back from having served their country and having paid a great debt both physical and mental and emotional, and then trying to build something beautiful out of that. And so Pippin represents for me really that moment of transition, moving from the 19th century into the modern era, and how we will see America at that time.
Well, and even to spend a little time talking about his experiences in World War I, Judith, he was part of this regiment, the 369th Regiment, known as the Harlem Hellfighters. And I was reading about half of these soldiers died in combat. They were awarded the Cross of War. That's France's highest honor for their bravery. And he's quoted as saying that the war brought out all the art in me.
It did. His horizons expanded. While he was a soldier, he made drawings. And when he came back, he made notebooks of explosions, of mines, of soldiers fighting in the trenches, of soldiers repairing their shirts in the dugouts. The war just was an incredibly vivid thing. There was one thing I was going to add about Pippin, which is when art, we're supposed to think when art reminds you of life, it's good. But with Pippin, it's when life reminds you of art. And I can't tell you how many times I'm going around the Philadelphia area and I see a sky with the tracery of leafless branches against white clouds in a blue sky, and I see Pippin.
Yeah.
So he's really changed the way I look at life. And to me, that's the mark of a great artist.
And we should say that he was wounded in his right arm and really was disabled after the war. And if I can go back to you, Judith, how do you think that influenced him as an artist and just the way he approached his work?
Well, it made certain restrictions, and he, in fact, took up painting as a way of rehabilitating his arm. He first began by using a hot poker on wood, which was a craft hobby thing that many people did, but no one used it quite the way Pippin did to make his own pictures. And he would take the extra oak leaves from tables that people would have around and cut them up as his quote-unquote canvases.
Right.
But soon he began to work with oil paints and kept going in new directions.
And I'm trying to imagine serving in World War I. First of all, Gwendolyn, just surviving that and then coming back. He served in a segregated military, coming back to a segregated, largely segregated America. Do we know how perhaps political he was? I mean, you can certainly see that influence in some of his paintings.
Yeah. Well, Judith maybe knows more about his politics than I do, but that regiment, the 369th, the Harlem Hellfighters, was a hugely generative regiment. The band, for example, was led by James Rhys Europe, who had been a band leader for the Castles, for Vernon and Irene Castle, who popularized a number of dances in the 19-teens. And when the Hellfighters were over in France, they basically introduced jazz to Paris. Mm. And then, as we all know, in the 1920s, you have the jazz age taking off and all of that. And the Hellfighters had a big influence on that, which is part of why, in addition to their valor, they were recognized by the French government. When most of those soldiers came back to the United States, they encountered just as much racism as when they had left. And some soldiers who returned in uniform and expected to be treated differently, in segregated society, particularly in the South, sometimes they were attacked and lynched. And horrible, horrible things happened to black veterans after World War I. And I think it, particularly in Mr. Prejudice, which is one of the paintings
powerful
that we have online, you can see that dilemma of the black soldier returning, coming back in uniform and coming back wounded, and having the big V of victory kind of pounded in half by the figure of Mr. Prejudice, that these men had laid down their lives and sacrificed so much, and then to come back to a situation which in large part, in some ways was perhaps worse than what they had left. You know, in 1915, for example, Birth of a Nation, this film by D.W. Griffith, which celebrates the mythical birth of the Ku Klux Klan, but in reality gave birth to a new Klan, what we call the second or the third Klan, which was hugely, which grew in numbers in the 1920s. So I think it must have been very difficult for him to come back and to be wounded and not to be fully the man that he was when he left.
Well, and I should say to our listeners, we have put some of Horace Pippin's work on our webpage at whyy.org, including this painting called Mr. Prejudice. I'm holding a copy of it, Judith, right, in my hand. And here you have on the right, here's a KKK guy. There's this V that sort of like rips the painting in the middle. There's a shirtless man holding, it looks like an axe or a hammer over his head. Very dramatic. You've got white people on one side, black people on another side. What does this painting tell us about Horace Pippin?
Yeah, this painting, which is in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, if you want to go and see it in person, it has the Statue of Liberty. The V is centrally located, and it's being pulled apart by the forces of prejudice, which is this evil-looking guy. But on one side, which all the people are dark-skinned, the Statue of Liberty is dark-skinned as well. And you see a sailor, you see all of the armed services, and you see a black doctor. But on the right side, you see white men and in uniform as well as a kind of a lyncher, a guy with a rope in his hand, and a figure of the Ku Klux Klan. So he's making it extremely vivid as to what's at stake here, the very course of victory in the war if we don't stop this, evil prejudice.
And that's a painting that's actually dated from 1943, but this other painting, 1933, this is the end of the war, starting home, and I guess his first oil painting, and again, it's showing trench warfare. There's a soldier with his hands up in the middle of the painting.
It's a remarkable painting in that it's the only one we know that has a whittled frame, and there's all of these little images of wall material, grenades and tanks and helmets around the edges, and it's the only one like it. And he was so proud of this painting that on the back, which is nothing you could ever see, right, but the museum, Philadelphia Museum, again, the home of this painting, knows it. It says, his first painting. So it took him several years to do it.
And we're almost having a break here, but would you say he was discovered? I mean, he was clearly working in Westchester. Some of his work was in store windows, and so he was painting.
He was painting. He was sharing his art. He was giving it to his stepson's teacher. He was giving it to the barber. He had a little show in a music shop. And all of these little presences did get to the people who make things happen. Christian Brinton was one, and C. Wyeth, as you said. And so in 1938, there was a show at the Chester County Art Association that really brought him to the fore, because Andy Wyeth, who was then a very young man, won the second prize in that show, and Pippin got honorable mention.
There you go. Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. And we are talking about African-American artist Horace Pippin. He was born 125 years ago in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He spent some time living in New York. He served in World War I, as we've been talking about, came back and spent a lot of his adult life in Westchester. His work is on view at a number of local museums, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 and talking with Judith Stein and Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Studio Incaminati School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City supports WHYY and presents an open house March 16th and 17th. Professional teaching artists provide live model painting demonstrations and individual portfolio reviews. These artists will explain how the innovative curriculum fuses classical traditions and the luminous color of the Impressionists with a modern sensibility. Information on full and part-time drawing, painting, and sculpture programs, scholarships, continuing ed classes, and workshops at studioincaminati.org.
Grammy season has come and gone, and year after year it seems like the same handful of artists get all the awards, all the radio play, and all the attention. So that's where we come in. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. This week on Sound Opinions, it's Buried Treasures. We dig deep to highlight some great albums that have slipped through the mainstream cracks.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Is winning all about luck or skill? What would you say if we told you that new research suggests neither? Winners simply put failure out of their minds.
If you focus on the odds, you tend not to take the risk.
What it takes to be top dog in a competitive world. We'll talk about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Judith Stein. She's a writer and independent art curator. Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw is associate professor of American art at the University of Pennsylvania. We are talking about African-American artist Horace Pippin, and this year marks his birth 125 years ago. Joining us now is Jen Bryant, author of a book called A Splash of Red, The Life and Art of Horace Pippin. It's a book for kids. And Jen Bryant, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan, Marty.
Well, thank you so much. Why did you want to write a children's book about Horace Pippin?
Well, Horace kind of found me when I was taking my students from Westchester University's writing class to the Brandywine River Museum, and I came across his painting, Saying Prayers. So that started back in about 2004. I was just really taken by that painting and decided that I would find out more about him, and did some research and wrote a manuscript and submitted it. But the first time, the editors thought maybe there wasn't enough that would be interesting enough for kids. But then I worked on it a little bit more and found some scenes and anecdotes from his early life, and we worked it out. He is just so... he's just so courageous in a straightforward and honest way in his life and in his art. I just thought it would be a good story for kids to have.
And I would say kids like those kinds of stories, yes?
Yes, they do. And I think particularly with Horace, it was art was something that was a part of him from early childhood. And like all great artists, He used what he had immediately at hand, and so he won an art contest when he was 10. That was kind of a turning point for him because he could see himself as a real artist when he had real art supplies. But previous to that, he would just use broken crayons or a piece of charcoal, whatever he could find, and he would make pictures. And he really, when he came back from the war and his he actually had a steel plate inserted into his right shoulder when he was after he was shot by a sniper, and you can read his war notebooks. Actually, they're digitized at the Smithsonian Archives of American Art, and they're so compelling and so he just handled all of the difficulties of his life with such grace, and was able then to communicate that to us later on in his art.
And you call your book A Splash of Red. Why that title?
Yes. In fact, I'm not very good at titles, Marty.
Okay.
I tend to try and let those emerge from the story, and sometimes that's the very last thing that comes. And in fact, the illustrator, Melissa Sweet, who has just masterfully brought his life to the page in this book, and she lives in Rockport, Maine. And we worked together on a previous book about William Carlos Williams called A River of Words. But she came up with that title. And I think it was just, it was wonderful because it works on several different levels. One, the literal level of his use of red in his own paintings. As a writer, not an art historian like Judith or Gwendolyn, that is something that you notice in his paintings. His use of color was something that struck me immediately, and so it works on that level. But also, his war experience was pivotal, and of course, he came back to art and making art as a kind of psychological and physical therapy. It's just one of those things. It's a great story. You can't make this stuff up, and he left us this beautiful gift of his art.
Well, Judith, it's interesting because I think not all artists' life would appeal to both children and adults, but I think Horace Pippin's does.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. And that's one of the wonderful things about when you look at the arc of his life. The art was always there for him. And as I think Judith pointed out, his eyes, his observation, and I think another thing that comes, hopefully, organically through the message of his story to kids is that art is work. You know, you have to pay attention, and it takes time. I hope that's something that they can take away from this. And he loved it, yes, but he also worked at it.
Indeed,
and that's
did.
Important to note.
Yeah, go ahead, Judith.
Yeah, speaking to Pippin's eye, there's a painting in the Barnes Foundation, which is going to be on the website. I believe it's Christ and the Woman of Samaria, which he took the format from a print that he had seen. But the sky is magenta and streaked. It's very dramatic, but there are skies like that. We've
right.
seen them, and apparently he was going over the Pulaski Skyway on a trip from New York to Philadelphia one day and saw a sky like that, and he incorporated it into his painting.
Gwendolyn, anything you want to add to that?
I think with Pippin's religious paintings, you get another side of him as well, this desire to make visible both the stories of the past that we rely on to kind of guide our lives, but also to bring them into his world and into his moment through his own signature style. So as Judith describes these incredible clouds that he made in some of the paintings, they look almost like, what did you call them earlier, potato chips? You know, they're very distinct.
Carved out, right?
Yeah, they're very full, and it was almost as if he took every object and gave it individual respect, so that each
every
thing,
leaf on the tree, mm-hmm. in fact, seems that way.
Yeah, each thing he honors.
Well, Jen, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Congratulations on your book as well.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem. And the book is called A Splash of Red, The Life and Art of Horace Pippin. And Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw, staying with us for the rest of the hour, Associate Professor of American Art at the University of Pennsylvania. And Judith Stein, also staying with us for the rest of the hour. She's a writer, independent art curator, and we are talking about the life and the art of Westchester-born Horace Pippin, born 125 years ago this year, and his work is at the Barnes Foundation, also at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Brandywine, other
and the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and it's also on our website at whyy.org/radiotime, so please go there and check it out. Going back to what we were talking about right before the break, if you don't mind, Judith Stein, and this idea, I guess, of being discovered as his work was on view in Westchester, and then there was this Chester County art show. Did that really just propel him into the sort of national stage?
Well, he wasn't like Lana Turner sitting on a Schraff's counter, but word does get out, and artists really began to get excited. There was a woman by the name of Elizabeth Sparhook Jones who lived in Westchester, who knew a dealer in New York named Hudson Walker, whose family was founded the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. And Walker had the work in New York. He didn't sell much, and he didn't seem to show it. But somebody, I think it was Christian Brinton, prevailed on Robert Carlin from Philadelphia to brought Carlin up to New York to Hudson Walker's gallery, where he saw it and he said, "That's it, I'm giving you a show."
Oh, wow.
So, January 1940, Carlin has this show for Pippin, and on the day that his last show was turning over and he had the Pippins laid out against the floorboards, ready to take the old show down and put the new one up, Albert Barnes came. And he to see the Hugh Mezeboff, the artist from the other show, and that's when Barnes, his fire was lit for Pippin. And once Barnes got in on it, then things quickened a great deal.
Gwendolyn, it's interesting to read about how art critics and journalists at that time wrote about Horace Pippin, and you can see, I mean, the language is sort of uncomfortable today, but the use of the word primitive, there were other words that used to describe his work, because it wasn't like, you know, some of the quote-unquote masters of the time.
Yeah, the ways that self-taught artists were discussed during the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s relied on a lot of this language, which today is incredibly out of fashion.
Yes.
But at the moment was seen as describing a kind of natural, innate ability to see the world in a certain way and then to transcribe it onto canvas or another surface. You get these discovery tropes connected to almost every self-taught artist. You know, we have a lot of different terms that we use for these artists, self-taught, mm-hmm. outsider, visionary. Mm-hmm. Many of them only get recognition later in their lives, as Pippin did when he was about 50. While others, are working through their whole lives producing things, it's only until they are, quote unquote, discovered. And for many African American artists, this discovery moment can only happen when a white viewer comes along and recognizes the marketability mm-hmm. and the the visual interest, the popular visual interest in their work. And so you get, especially in the 1930s, a lot of this discovery happening around black artists. Bill Traylor, for example, who is a Southern artist, is discovered in this moment by another white artist. Clementine Hunter in the 1940s is also discovered down in Natchitoches, Louisiana. And one can only imagine all of the artists who were doing work who never had somebody come along mm-hmm. and say, oh, your work is compositionally exciting and you use color in so many remarkable ways. Let us share it with other people. And, you know, I think that's in some ways a nicer way to think of it, you know, because discovery implies that, that this person's work didn't really exist or right. couldn't be seen or wasn't being shared in the community like Pippin's was in Westchester.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. If I can go back, it looks like you want to say something, Judith. No, okay, because I want to go back to Horace Pippin's relationship with Albert Barnes, because it seems like an interesting one. And there's a quote.
Was there any relationship that he had with anybody that wasn't interesting?
Well, exactly. But apparently at one point, Albert Barnes was giving Horace Pippin some advice about how to paint. And Horace Pippin is quoted as basically saying, you know, I don't tell you how to run your foundation. Don't tell me how to paint.
Yeah, I think,
I like that.
I like the story too.
Yeah.
Who knows if it's true
or not?
But it has the ring of truth to it. I mean, Pippin was self-possessed. He knew who he was, and he knew. And the most interesting thing is he and many other self-taught artists regard themselves as realists. He painted what he saw. One of them, you know, I was thinking about that, and Gwendolyn and I were talking about, you know, he was at the Barnes Foundation. He was actually there for several months. How did that impact on him? Because he was such a visually acute man. Well, one thing is that still lifes start turning up as a subject matter that he was interested in painting, and he starts composing them after he's spent some time in the Barnes Foundation. So Barnes, I think Barnes was just interested in his work, you know, from the beginning to the end. He did want to get it at the lowest prices he could, and his relationship with Carling, you know, fell to pieces because they couldn't agree on the prices, but he was there for Pippin.
It's funny, the more you look at Pippin's work, the more you see Rousseau. I mean, you see not just the influence, but the fact that things were happening in the art world different from previous times, and you see it in Pippin's work. Do you see it, Judith?
Yeah, but you know what? I see Barnes's taste, because Barnes's taste, he loved Rousseau, but, you know, and John Cane. There were other self-taught artists. So it came in. He was somebody who was fully formed. It's hard to say. Or it would be for me right now to think about just how Pippin's work changed after seeing the Barnes. I think it was really, he came in, as an entity, perhaps some of the colors that he saw, but certainly the genre of still life.
Indeed. He did several, I think three paintings of John Brown, you know, a controversial figure, historical figure. But Gwendolyn, I'm sure for a lot of African Americans, because he wanted to free the slaves, essentially, and take on the U.S. government, a hero. But he has three very interesting paintings of John Brown.
Yeah, for Pippin, I think John Brown and both Abraham Lincoln are the two main historical figures that he works through in his work, telling multiple stories, multiple scenes from their lives or legends, if you will. His painting of John Brown going to his hanging, which is on view right now at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in the historical building. I stopped and took a look at it on Saturday. And when you see it in person, it really pops for you. The colors especially, the blue, the gingham of the old woman's skirt in the lower right-hand corner really sings and rhymes with the blue in the upper corner. The composition itself is a scene of a group of men who have gathered to watch John Brown go to his hanging, and they're all gathered around the in the lower register of the painting, and Brown rides on the back of a wagon that is being drawn by several white horses. And as I mentioned in the lower corner, there's a lone black woman who is witnessing this moment in 1859 when this rebel activist, John Brown, who has sent his sons to die for the cause of African American liberation, is being led to the gallows. And the legend behind it is that either Pippin's mother or his grandmother, one of his female relatives, was there that day in Charlestown, Virginia, what is now West Virginia, and witnessed this. And so he has her there in the lower corner facing the viewer and kind of addressing us with this look of it's almost disgust. I don't know that it's quite that strong, but it's an unhappy look on her face as everybody else in the composition turns toward the rebel to kind of see him, go to his just desserts.
Well, and Judith, as a viewer, most of the people in this painting have their back to the viewer,
really very dynamic kind of way of coming into a scene. Yeah, we're standing behind the crowd and we're watching this sea of men we only see their backs and their hats, and each hat is distinct. It's a slightly different shade of gray. Gwendolyn mentioned the blue of the gingham dress and the blue of the sky, but otherwise the painting is in quiet, muted browns and blacks and tones of white. I have to. It's an extraordinary painting. When I was researching it, I went and watched this very long Santa Fe Trail from 1940. So if you have a mind to sit through it, towards the very end, they reenact John Brown going to his hanging. And it was then that I realized all this sitting and watching this 1940s movie was worth it, because I think that Pippin did see that movie. The way that it was portrayed was very much like this, with Brown trussed up with rope in a open wagon pulled by white horses and so on. And that's one of the things. I mean, even folk or self-taught artists have sources, and that's just a whole fascinating subject in and of itself. But Pippin went to the movies, and he looked at calendar art, and he, you know, all kinds of things came his way.
And this painting, we're almost up at a break here, but is 1942, so that would maybe fit with
Absolutely.
When this movie came out. Well, we are talking about the life and art of Horace Pippin. Horace Pippin grew up in Westchester, in fact, was born 125 years ago this year. He was seriously wounded during World War I, came back and as a kind of art as therapy, turned himself into an artist. His work is on view at a number of museums here in the Philadelphia area, and I'm talking with Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw and Judith Stein. Any questions or comments you might have about Horace Pippin, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held Wednesday, March 5th in room 202 of the College Building, 1025 Walnut Street. Registration by phone 215-503-0174 or online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. The Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health, bringing health and healthcare together.
The legendary Boston criminal, Whitey Bulger, who inspired Jack Nicholson's character in the film The Departed, was wanted for 19 murders when he was captured after 16 years on the lam. While pursuing his criminal career, Bulger was informing, too, and getting protection from the FBI. On the next Fresh Air, two journalists who've covered his story join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Bullying, from the playground to cyberspace. It can be a minefield of teasing, taunting, threatening, shunning, and sometimes physical harm. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, we'll look at bullying's many forms, its cultural roots, and when and how to intervene. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the African-American artist Horace Pippin, who was born 125 years ago. Our guests are Judith Stein. She's a writer and independent curator. About 20 years ago, she curated an exhibition of the art of Horace Pippin called I Tell My Heart. It was here at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and also at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw, also with us. She's an associate professor of American art at the University of Pennsylvania, and her work focuses on race and gender, sexuality and class in the art of the U.S. and the New World. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We were talking a bit about John Brown. He also, and we should say on our website, you can check it out, has a painting of Abraham Lincoln, the Good Samaritan. And if you go to whyy.org/radiotimes, you can check it out. And Gwendolyn, what do you see in this painting?
Well, in the painting, it's a snowy day, and there are a couple of, they look like log cabins with snow on their roofs. And in the foreground is the figure of Abraham Lincoln, a much younger Lincoln than we think of him today. He's clean shaven, and he's tall and kind of rangy and thin, as we would expect him to be. And he's trudging through the snow, approaching a young boy who seems to be, who's attempting to chop up some wood, presumably to take back to one of the homes in the background. But the boy looks like he's having a very difficult time.
Yes, he does.
You know, his head is wrapped up in some kind of a cloth, perhaps to keep it warm, and his feet have wrappers on them as well, as though he does not, he doesn't have boots. And we see this in contrast to the feet of Lincoln, which have these kind of high knee-high boots as he goes through the snow. And Lincoln's hand is reaching out towards the boy in a gesture, perhaps, of, you know, let me take on your load.
And Judith, we see this sky again that you have been talking about in this painting as well. Obviously, he painted people that he thought were heroes in his life.
Yes, they were. And he did several different episodes in Lincoln's life. In the Barnes Foundation, up above a doorway, you'll find Lincoln and his father building a log cabin. So that's just one of several that he did of Lincoln.
Well, it's interesting to paint not Lincoln as president so much, but Lincoln as a regular person.
Right, and he did also do a painting of Lincoln standing in a tent during the Civil War, looking very presidential. Mm-hmm. One that I think actually is based on a Matthew Brady photo. Interesting stuff.
He did meet in Chicago, I believe it was, Salvador Dali. And I'm just trying to imagine a meeting between Horace Pippin and Salvador Dali in Chicago, Illinois.
Do we
know what happened?
Well, I think we have somebody's account of it. You know, here's Pippin, hail fellow, well met, just really open, easy. And you have the wonderful neurotic genius of Salvador Dali, and they each had a show, and of course the crowd had all come to see Dali, and the description was that Pippin's rooms were rather quiet. Mm-hmm. He was by no means well known, but Pippin sought him out at some point and went over to him and stuck out his hand and to shake it, and then Dali was going to, but then I think decided not to, and withdrew his arm. Oh, I think Pippin said, oh, and you're a painter too. And this was too much for Dolly.
And then he went and he sulked in the corner the rest of the evening.
Exactly. Oh, goodness gracious. Perhaps telling us just, you know, I guess Horace Pippin as an outsider. I mean, he wasn't part of this accepted art scene as you know, as out there as Salvador Dali was.
Very few would have been as out there as Dali. Right. So I think another artist less weird would have accepted a proffered handshake with greater warmth.
They're also, and we have them on our website as well, Gwendolyn saying prayers and also supper time. And Horace Pippin painted these wonderful family scenes where you just get this sense of family life.
Yeah, he has this ability to show us kind of simple African-American lives, led with dignity and with self-respect. And these images tend to be among his most popular, I think, in terms of reproduction. You know, part of this is a kind of contemporary desire that that viewers have to see African-American life and culture through its creators and its painters. The ways that he renders these images is so remarkable, showing individuals in kind of contemplative, simple settings, sometimes with their laundry hanging about the room. There's no sense of kind of guile or I'm trying to search for the word.
Oh, artifice.
It just seems artifice.
Yeah.
Well, it feels very intimate, too.
Yeah, and he gets the weather right. I mean, both of these paintings that you mentioned, saying prayers, it's winter time, and there is frost on the inside, so it must have been a really cold interior, but there's a pot-bellied stove and a kettle, and a coffee pot with little steam coming out. So one gets a sense of safety and the hearth and the presence of a strong woman.
Indeed. Did he enjoy his success, Judith? I mean, I feel sort of even weird the words I chose to ask that question.
Well, interesting question. I mean, I think from what I understand, he did. Alcohol was a problem, and his health began to deteriorate. It was a very quick run from having his first one-man show in 1940 and his death in 1946.
Wow.
So from the Chester County Art Association of 38 to his death, it's a span of 8 years. And he did become better known and certainly was earning money, but how much he really enjoyed it, I don't know.
Yeah, and his wife had problems, did she not?
She had her problems and died in very close proximity to him.
Mm. And did they have children?
There was Jenny, his wife, his stepson, Richard Wade, was a serving in World War II. So he was in active service. And so Pippin's thoughts would have very much been on, I've been here before, here we are again. And so his paintings on the peaceable kingdom that have furtive war scenes in the back of them, peace was very much a concern of his.
Let me get, looks like Olin from Kennett Square to join us. And Olin, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hello, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Good. Actually, I had a question, kind of comment for Judith. I actually own I'm about 95% sure is an original Horace Pippin.
Wow.
I've had it out to the Brandywine River Museum, and the curators out there believe it is. I actually met with Mark Bockroth, and I'm sure Judith knows Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked it over, and he was on the fence. He was 50-50. And he had actually given me her name and phone number to talk to, but I was just curious if maybe she might even be aware of this painting.
Well, and Olin, you know, you're doing this on the radio with thousands of people listening to you, but nonetheless, go ahead, Judith.
I think we should meet.
Yeah, exactly.
We should after you get off the phone. We'll exchange information, and I'd be happy to have a look at it.
Yeah, well, we'll get your phone number and try to hook you two up. Let me go.
Have you ever heard of a painting he did that was of a carnival scene?
Of a carnival scene. Does that Nope. Ring a bell? Nope.
Rings no bells right now.
Green and White Park in Chester County.
Okay. Well, you know what? We're going to hook you two up, and you can hopefully figure this out off the air. But, Olin, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Gwendolyn, if I can toss this to you, any way to know about his relationship with other black artists at the time? Or maybe, I don't know if that's a Judith question, but I'd be curious.
Yeah, he was connected with a number of artists, including Claude Clark, right, who was a very, who had a strong relationship with him and would help him to transport his paintings, working for Robert Carlin for the dealer up to New York City. I think he was very open to artists who wanted to, have intellectual and creative exchanges with him. During his time taking classes at the Barnes Foundation, there were a number of other African-American mm-hmm. artists who were there and took classes with him, and other black artists who were there at a much earlier period as well. You know, I think we often think about the American segregation as holding everyone apart. And in general, what I've found is that artists tend to be among the most interested in knowing each other and being helpful to each other. Artists do. And they don't see color quite in the, you know, as something that's going to limit that. And I think that made Pippin, it gave him a broader world. Through those classes at the Barnes, getting in contact with local artists who were availing themselves of that opportunity as well.
Judith, you want to add to that?
There's a harmony between Jacob Lawrence and Horace Pippin, and I was really happy to learn that they were showing in the same gallery in New York saw each other's work. This was the Downtown Gallery. But it well may be that Lawrence came to his rather primitivizing style on his own and for separate reasons, but there was that they in New York they were seeing each other's work, but there was also resentment about Pippin because he did not go to the when I say the academy, I don't mean specific one, but through the training, academic training, and yet he was having financial success. And in fact, Lawrence, when I interviewed him about this, said this was true for him as well. Sure. You know, artists, it was so tough to get shown that those who did manage to get shown and sell were resented by some.
And he did. Go ahead, Gwendolyn.
Well, and then you have artists like William H. Johnson, yes. Who is who is very, you know, strongly trained academically and goes and lives in France and in Denmark for a number of years and learns to paint in all sorts of modernist styles. And then when he returns to the United States in the 1930s, he begins to see this rise of quote-unquote primitive art and that's what's getting the attention. Mm-hmm. And as he sees Pippin's shows, William Edmondson, getting exhibitions at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, his style shifts also, and he begins to paint in what we would call a naive style and takes up topics, takes up subjects that we see Pippin working on. He does John Brown, he does Abraham Lincoln, and it's a way that he can, you know, capture that zeitgeist as well.
Let me get, looks like Carl from Devon to join our conversation, and Carl, go ahead, you are on Radio Times.
I love your program.
Thank you.
My question is, how did he support himself before he started earning money as an artist?
Judith?
I think they lived very simply, he and his wife. He had disability benefits because of his injury, and his wife was a laundress.
And that's how they made a modest income.
A modest income, and they lived in a small house in Westchester.
On Gay Street.
On Gay Street, yes.
And what does the house look like?
I just saw it from the outside. It's just, you know, a sweet house with windows on the front and a big backyard.
And does someone live there, or is
I believe so, and I'm sure there's a historical marker there now.
Fair enough. And he died in 1946.
He did.
And he was what, 50 about 58 years old?
Yes. And there were very he didn't leave an estate because the paintings were selling. You know, even the unfinished one on his easel got sold.
Wow.
So his family inherited nothing, and there were no papers to speak of.
Wow. Yeah. Let me get, looks like Mary from media to join our conversation. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was wondering if Pippin had any affiliation with Lincoln University given that Barnes had left them in charge of his collection, or if Pippin had any connection with maybe Westchester University since he lived in Westchester.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm back at you, Judith.
I think the answer is no in both camps, okay. But I'm really not an expert.
Okay. Yeah, well, that relationship with Lincoln really gets going a lot later.
Yeah.
And Barnes doesn't die until the 1950s.
At 51.
Right? 51,
yeah.
Which is you know, after Pippin dies. Yeah. I think there is some connection to Cheney University, though, various... presidents of Cheney and academic administrators attended his exhibitions, and I think that kind of proximity was much more generative in terms of making a university connection.
Mary, thanks for your call to Radio Times. Gwendolyn, an unfair question. Do you have a favorite Pippin painting?
Oh, I like the John Brown. Well, the one where he's going to his hanging. I think it's especially resonant. I'm a big fan of 19th century painting of all sorts. And for me, this is a painting that really looks back to 19th century traditions and to the place of John Brown in the lives of African Americans following the Civil War and Reconstruction. Many black folks had on their walls images of Brown, images of Abraham Lincoln. They would have been more kind of traditional imaginary scenes from the life of Brown, like him kissing the baby on the stairs of the courthouse on his way to a hanging. But what I love about Pippin's is that he's created this scene for himself. And I know Judith said that, you know, he's adopted this scene from Hollywood film.
Yeah.
But having his grandmother in there really personalized it, and it shows the importance of this story to African American lives at a moment a half a century later when it still resonated for them and it still was a beacon of hope.
Well, I know we could, I know you want to say something, Judith, but the clock is telling me we are out of time. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Judith Stein, thank you for coming back on the show. And she's a writer, independent art curator. Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw, thank you very much for joining us as well. Associate Professor of American Art at the University of Pennsylvania. And again, you can go to whyy.org/Radio Times to see these Pippin paintings that we have put online. You can also check out the Radio Times archives. You can find us on Facebook, information about Twitter, email, and satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Heather Bromfield, our intern today. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.